Welcome to the Everyday Innovator Podcast for product managers and innovators. Your host is Chad McAllister, helping product managers become product masters. Listen and get ready to take your career to the next level, for the doctor is in.
Hi, this is Chad, your host, and this is where product managers become product masters. These are the product people and innovators that become the leaders in organizations. Check out how to become a product master using my free product mastery roadmap at the same place where you'll find the show notes for this episode. And that's theeverydayinnovator.com/127. This is a listener-suggested episode, which I love doing. I enjoy receiving emails from listeners asking for specific topics to explore. And several people have recently asked about business-to-business, B2B, product management. A B2B company sells its products to other organizations, while a B2C, a business-to-consumer company, provides its products to consumers. And to explore this topic, I asked Jeff Lash to join us. Jeff is a recognized thought leader in product management with over a decade of experience in the development of web-based products and SaaS systems. His product management career includes both new product launches and major turnarounds of existing product lines, as well as the creation of the product management role inside some organizations. He has significant expertise in customer understanding, new product innovation, agile product management, user experience design, and product development processes. And he's the vice president at Sirius Decisions, a research and advisory company for B2B organizations. While the focus of our discussion is on product management for business-to-business sort of companies, there certainly are tips and practices for the B2C product manager as well. Hope you enjoy the discussion. Jeff, thanks for joining the Everyday Innovators.
Absolutely. It's great to be here with you.
Glad we can also talk about B2B product management. I do get this question a fair bit about, you know, what really are the aspects of B2B product management in terms of how do they differ from B2C? And, you know, we it seems like people in that space run into some other issues that they're not sure the B2C people run into. And this is the conversation to dive into that a little bit. So let's start with just addressing that comparison. Can you talk about how B2B product management really differs from B2C?
You know, so you hear this term a lot that people use in terms of, oh, you know, product management is like running a business within a business or something like that. And I think in B2B, that really is the case in a lot of situations where really, you know, a product group is its own little business with inside the larger business. And when you think about how businesses operate, you've got a number of different functions. You've got marketing and sales and product and finance and other things. And I think you're in B2B really on a regular basis interacting with those other functions and trying to coordinate and collaborate across those groups. Whereas, you know, a lot of the folks that I run into who are in B2C, they really don't, in many cases, not all, but in many cases, don't really own the whole product. They might say, well, I'm the product manager for search, or I'm the product manager for this page of a component. So you're not really in charge of all the business, right? And nothing against that. It's just, I think, a different animal. What I'm also seeing recently is that there seems to be much more of a change in terms of kind of where the focus and attention is, particularly for web-based products, for SaaS products. So it seems like a lot of the direction things are going in B2C is very much in the form of much more involved in UX and much more involved in kind of very detailed level interactions on a page. Versus in B2B, you know, yes, the UX is very important, but, you know, the color of a link on a page in a B2B application is not really going to change our revenue. You know, what's going to change our revenue is the value proposition and the sales channel and things like that. Versus if you're talking about particularly high volume consumer sites, right, the color of a link might actually have a huge impact on advertising revenue or things like that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm seeing just in terms of where product managers themselves are, The topics they're interested in, the things they're thinking about are starting to diverge a bit. I hope it doesn't diverge too much, because I worry that in B2C, product management becomes basically just kind of a feature functionality design manager. But in B2B, I mean, the clients that I'm working with, the companies I'm talking to on a day-to-day basis, they're dealing with a lot of the same challenges that product managers have had for a long time, right? Mm-hmm. How do I grow my product? How do I grow revenue? How do I make sure that the sales team is successful and enabled? And how do I identify the right partners that we want to work with to make my product successful in the market?
And a lot of those aspects are the same, whether we're serving, you know, individual consumers, B2C, or we're serving a business itself. We're still developing a product to add value for them. Like you said, you know, key thing is value there for both groups. Mm-hmm. It does seem like a distinguishing factor can be this issue of how much of the product you own. And that varies a lot, you know, like you gave the example of search. You know, I've talked to, we call product managers program managers at Microsoft, which is interesting to me. But the product managers at Microsoft, you know, they might own one aspect of Microsoft Word, right? And mm-hmm. not the whole thing. And this changes a lot by company. But in B2B, you're probably more likely to have ownership over that product. And a distinction I see a lot, too, is how product managers in B2B, I'll say, get sucked into the sales process more frequently. And I wanted to ask you about that. How does the B2B sales model impact product management? And let's just tease that out a little bit.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, so it does. I mean, I think that's probably, again, another big differentiator. So again, in a lot of B2C situations, it's, you know, you might be trying to sell a product to a, you know, consumer, right? So there might be direct sales or retail. You're typically not involved as much maybe with the sales force or the distribution model, or it's an advertising driven site, which is a completely different model in itself versus, mm-hmm. yeah, in most B2B situations, even companies that do have direct e-commerce, a lot of them still have direct or indirect sales forces. So that's, you know, that's one of the things that we focus on at Serious Decisions when we talk about, you know, the role of product management and the responsibilities is really this idea of interlocking between product and marketing and sales. Because you can have the greatest product in the world and it can have the greatest positioning and messaging behind it. But if your sales team does not know how to sell it, or they're not comfortable talking to that persona, or, you know, they're not incentivized to sell it or not compensated properly for selling it, then it doesn't matter how great your product is. So, you know, I think there's definitely much more of a responsibility with sales for B2B than there is for B2C. Now, I agree with you. I've seen cases where people get too sucked in, right? And I think that's the balance. And that's a struggle for many companies, right? Mm-hmm. What's the appropriate level of support we should give to sales without having to, you know, respond to every question from every sales rep or be on every call on every deal? And I think the organizations that we've seen that are successful, right, have a good balance there. Part of it is making sure that the responsibilities for product managers are clear in terms of what they should be doing with sales, in terms of the support they're providing. Part of it also, quite frankly, I've seen a lot of organizations where product managers get sucked into working with sales because there isn't a strong product marketing function.
Right.
So in our view, you know, product marketing is really responsible for the transfer of knowledge to the sales organization. And that knowledge is product knowledge, but market knowledge, buyer persona knowledge, all those sorts of things. And when you don't have a strong product marketing function, then a lot of times that falls on product management. And when you don't have good sales knowledge transfer, you know, the salespeople need help with every deal and they're calling you up. Mm-hmm. So I think there's certainly a benefit to working with sales because it establishes relationships. It helps you get a good understanding of what questions are coming out from customers and from prospects. But I think the bigger challenge I see sometimes is, yeah, how much support do we give without, you know, spending all day responding to requests or creating things one-off for individual sales reps?
Yeah, I think there are opportunities there. You know, there's some charm and allure to all this. You know, the first time you have a new product that comes out and you're working with the sales team and the sales team is just loving you as the product manager because you know more about the product than anyone. You're probably pretty good at going out and positioning it with the customers, and the sales people will ask you to do that, right? And that feels good for a while until none of your other work starts getting done. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, it's especially with a new product release, that is really a helpful experience to get some direct feedback. And now that we've launched the product, did we craft the proposition messages right? You know, how we're positioning the product? And does that need to be tweaked a little bit? Like you said, a strong product marketing function would take that on. But in those first you know, early days of a new product, it is nice to have that, you know, hands-on insight too as a product manager.
Yeah. So, I mean, really, I think, again, this is one of the big differences in B2B versus B2C. You know, I think there's another aspect of this as well that for B2B, you usually have multiple different personas involved, right? For B2C, if you're creating a product and, you know, you're trying to get someone to buy it, it's that person that you really care about, right? The user is the buyer. Versus in B2B, it's different. Mm-hmm. So not only is there usually a user and a buyer, oftentimes there are multiple buyers. And so I think a lot of the companies we deal with, you might have you know, there's several different buyer roles they're working with. Right. There's the decision maker, there's the champion, there's the influencer. And one of the things I think that is a challenge for many product managers, and quite frankly, for many sales teams, is really getting a handle on those different buyer roles, mm-hmm. and also understanding them at the appropriate level. So for example, a lot of times product managers are very focused on the users, right? The people who are using the product, the features and functionality they want. And that's great. But, you know, let's take a technology product. If I can't get the director of compliance or the IT security manager to sign off on that purchase, if the security requirements, the security features in the product aren't up to snuff and it doesn't pass their test, then we're never going to get to the user. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one difference in terms of the number of personas. And from a sales perspective, it's also about making sure that the sales force understands who those different personas are and how the roles they play in the buying process and what questions to ask, what things to talk about with them. So, you know, when you're talking to the CFO about a purchase, you're going to speak to them differently than a CIO. And when I'm looking at my product roadmap, I need to understand the different personas and understand, you know, what features do we need to add to address concerns from a certain persona. You know, maybe the user persona is really happy, but there's the gatekeeper who is the one who is often putting their foot down and quashing some of the deals. And we need to focus our roadmap more on addressing their concerns.
It's a really good point about the complications we have in B2B with this buying sequence, the different buying roles that are involved, and how we try to appeal to each of them. And sometimes there's things completely outside of our purview and control. You know, it's not uncommon to have someone sabotaging inside the company, you know, sabotaging the buy because they have some personal interest vested in a competitor, and you know nothing about this. But we do our best, right? And in this buying sequence, sometimes the organization can get it wrong too. Maybe the product manager can help identify this. I remember a case, this was many years ago, it was a web filtering company. They made software for enterprises to help make sure employees don't go to websites they should not be going to on company equipment. They were selling into the IT department because that was who implemented the solution. And they were finding a lot of, you know, they couldn't get traction. It was just very, very slow growth until they finally realized that the person with the pain in the organization is the HR compliance person. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're the ones that would bring in the solution. Sure, IT would implement it, but they're the ones with the actual problem. And it wasn't until they kind of figured out what their buying sequence actually was where they started to get growth in the situation.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great example. It's pretty typical. We see a lot of companies that are, not say moving away, but realizing, you know, they're trying to expand out of the IT buying center and they're going to HR, they're going to marketing or mm-hmm. operations or some other function for a lot of reasons like that. You know, the other thing that highlights, I think, is this really the importance of understanding buyer needs, right? So in your example, right, you know, IT doesn't have a need to keep people off websites. In fact, they might be the ones who really want to go to whatever websites they want.
Right.
Right. But the HR people have a problem, right? They have HR policies they need to uphold and whatnot. So, you know, we've done a lot of research at Serious Decisions over the past few years, and we introduced some a kind of big model and framework around, you know, the process for understanding buyer needs. And one of the things we talk about is understanding the different dimensions of a need, right? So in that case, right, there's, you know, that HR manager has a need, but the organization itself has a need, or right. The HR function has a level of need. And those, you know, at the end of the day, all the people in the company might be concerned about, you know, keeping the company safe and not getting viruses and not having lawsuits. But, you know, the IT manager is going to have a very different kind of personal view on that need versus the HR manager. And again, I think this is an example of where a lot of times I see B2B product managers focus so much on the users, right? Mm-hmm. So in your example, right, how should the software work? How does the administrative interface work? Or what happens if I go to a website I'm not supposed to? Versus thinking about, all right, who is that buyer and what does the buyer need and what do we need to build into the product to address those needs that we've identified that our buyers have?
Yeah, really good points. And keeping that full picture and perspective of who the buyers are. Now, there's another aspect when it comes to B2B sales that sometimes catches product managers off guard. And that's when we are told about a situation where a contract was signed and it has some functionality that was promised that isn't actually in the product.
Or that never happens.
That never happens. Or I'm sure what actually does happen more frequently, because that one never happens, is when sales professional comes back and says, you know, we must have feature X to close this deal. And a product doesn't have feature X yet. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about those conundrums some.
So yeah, those happen. Those tend to happen from right. time to time. I'll start with the big picture. I mean, we can talk about, you know, methods for prioritizing or how you assess feature requests and things like that. But I think it fundamentally starts with an understanding of the role of product management and an understanding of the role of sales and having alignment between the executives that are responsible for those functions. So if you have a CSO or VP of sales and you have a VP of product management or CPO, I think fundamentally it has to start with a good understanding between those two individuals, because I think a lot of it comes back to the culture of an organization. So I've seen companies that are very, very sales driven. Maybe the founder was a salesperson, or all the executives have come up through sales. So their organizational culture is, you know, if the customer wants this and it will close a deal, we say yes. I've seen companies that are very technology focused, right? The founder is a technologist, or all the, you know, they're very much an engineering centric culture. And, you know, they build things because they can, not necessarily because they can actually sell. So I think that has a big influence on some of these behaviors. And pretty much every situation I can think of where this has happened, you know, if you peel back the onion, so to speak, right, you find out what the underlying cause is. So the symptoms, you know, are, to use some medical terminology, right? You know, the symptoms might be, hey, you know, we're too many reps are selling, putting stuff into the contracts, but the disease underlying it might be, you know, there's just a not a good agreement about the understanding of how we prioritize and put things on the roadmap. So, for example, one of the things we published some research on recently is about, you know, what that relationship between the product executive and the sales executive needs to look like, and how can you get that in place? Because I think that would drive a lot of the right sort of behavior and that right balance.
I think this is a pretty thorny issue for a lot of B2B groups. And is that research you just mentioned publicly available?
I think we have some blog posts on it. Some of that's available for our clients, but I know we've written about this concept before. I mean, I think you're right. It is pretty thorny. One of the things, to kind of say, all right, so what do you actually do about it, right? Because mm-hmm. I think, you know, organizational culture is important, but obviously for a lot of the people listening to this, maybe you can't influence that yourself, you know, tomorrow. I think, you know, there's a couple techniques that I've seen that companies have done. So one is, there's a couple simple approaches. One is just saying, right, we're going to devote a certain percentage of our effort to things that sales requests, and agree on what that percentage is. So maybe that's 10%, maybe that's 20%, maybe it's 30%, whatever that number is that you can agree to, and say, look, a majority or a part of what we work on is things that are on the roadmap, that are longer pictures, longer term, bigger picture strategic things. And then we're going to allocate some percentage of our resources towards things that sales requests. And there's a number of different ways that you can, you know, prioritize those, have sales prioritize it, or you work with sales to prioritize it. But basically say, look, you know, we're not going to do everything. We're not going to take up 100% of our resources, because we do have things we need to do for longer term deals. We also longer term strategy. We also have things that we need to do maybe for existing clients to keep them happy. Maybe it doesn't directly bring in revenue, but we need to look at retaining our clients. Maybe there are certain things we need to do because we have technical debt. So that's a balance that the product manager needs to make. But we do want to respect the fact that sales has these requests. The other is, you know, when I think the second part of what you mentioned is, you know, hey, we need to do this to close this deal.
Right.
Well, I guess I would ask the question back to you. I'm sure you've seen this, Chad. So how many times does that deal actually close?
That is the big question, right?
So nothing against salespeople, because I think they're doing what they're doing what they think is best. And they're incented to do something, but you know, that to me is, there's a way to approach it. So I remember a situation I was in personally where we had this happen. The customer said, it was actually an existing customer, and they said, look, if you don't add this feature, we're going to leave. And so the push from senior management was, all right, we need to add this feature. So my response was, okay, great. Can we get them to lock in a 2-year contract?
Right.
And the response was, oh, no way we can do that. I said, well, okay, so we're going to do a whole bunch of work to develop a feature that based on all of the research we've done and all of our understanding of customers, we believe that only one customer really cares about. So what's in it for us? Because if we do all this work and they drop us anyways, then we basically just wasted a whole bunch of resources. So I think it's strategies like that. And then that actually made us go back and say, look, is this something we really want to do? And we had an honest, good conversation about it. Mm-hmm. I think another way you can do this, if you find yourself in the situation, is, you know, again, maybe tomorrow you can't broach that subject, but you can start tracking this. You know, okay, here was the 10 things that reps asked for last quarter that, quote unquote, we needed to close a deal. How many of those 10 opportunities actually closed? If it's 10 of them, then great. Actually, this is good. Then sales is bringing us the right things. If it's 1 out of 10, then that's data you can take back the next time a request comes in and says, okay, so, you know, we have a 10% success rate on this. So what do we think the likelihood of this deal is actually closing? And I think in the vast majority of cases, you take that sort of data to a business leader, sales or marketing or product or executive of any function, and say, look, you know, we're being told to do this work, but we have a very small percentage chance of this work actually paying off. I don't think anyone would realistically ask you to do that work. Mm-hmm. So, you know, data is the ultimate arbiter in many cases. So tracking your success rate in the past is one thing to do. You know, and even if not saying, I was advising one client on this, and I said, they were actually very, very sales driven. And so my advice was, first, before you, instead of saying no, just say, you know, yes, we'll do this, but let's agree that we'll track it, right? You know, this deal is going to, if we add this thing, it's going to get us $1 million. Okay, that we'll do it, but let's agree that we have a conversation 3 months from now and look back. And even by just kind of mentioning that before they actually did the work, it gave the sales rep or the sales manager some pause to say, oh yeah, there's going to be a cost to this for me. Cause if, again, I put myself in the perspective of a sales rep, if there's no cost for me to ask for a feature or ask for a change of the product, I'm just going to ask for anything I want.
Sure.
Right. But when you start saying there's a limited supply of work, or, you know, hey, you're going to have to, you know, if we approve this, then 6 months from now, you're going to be in a meeting and we're going to ask you whether you close this deal or not. Then I think it starts to give them pause. And again, not to say that salespeople are trying to do the wrong things. I think a lot of cases they have good intentions, but again, it's just like anything in life. If there's no cost for me to ask for something, I'm going to ask for anything, you know, as much as I can. Mm-hmm. So I think, and that's the challenge that product management has, right? That's our job, is to make those trade-offs and to do that analysis. And I don't think we should be expecting salespeople to, but I think we need to kind of understand, we need to make sure they understand that that's part of our job, and that there is, there are trade-offs that need to be made.
Yeah, these are good guardrails to put up. And I like the tip of, you know, setting aside a percent of the roadmap kind of effort, you know, maybe 10% set aside for sales requests. But, you know, anytime that sales are making these requests, you mentioned culture. So much of this is dependent on the culture. And as soon as a sales team gets accustomed to making requests and them just being accepted, then that becomes the norm. And I've been in organizations where it was the norm. And then thankfully, a senior leader would say, no, we're selling what we have today. Let's sell the product we have today and learn from our customers what they want, to what goes next. And being able to make that kind of culture change, and then, as you said, you know, tie this to something that's real. You know, if indeed the customer is asking for a new feature, or they won't sign the contract, well, that might be a really good opportunity for a product manager to go in and uncover what the actual need is. Because sometimes these mm-hmm. needs are... they're not real needs, right? It's like the customer is looking at all their buying options. They really like this cool report that another product has, and our product doesn't have it. You know, if you would only build that report, then we would do the contract with you. Well, probably we could go in and uncover how they're using that report and actually add more value to them than just taking that at face value. And a good salesperson should tie it to, well, we could deliver that in 6 months after you sign the contract, right? Let's get the contract signed first, get the commitment, and then make the implementation change.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I'd say, I think good sales reps, you know, don't come and say, I need this feature. They say, look, here's the client, or here's the prospect, and here's the challenge or the need that they have or the problem, and here's, you know, the problem we want to need to solve for them. Mm-hmm. But even in those cases, I think, yeah, it's still a great opportunity, as you mentioned, for product manager to say, right, let's go and let's uncover what is really going on there. Because I would say the vast majority of the time, you know, the email you get from sales says, hey, you need to add this report, right? That's really two or three steps removed from the actual problem they're trying to solve.
Right.
It reminds me of actually a situation I was in where I'll keep the story short, but essentially it was, you know, a salesperson relayed a request to me the customer wanted a certain feature. Long story short, once I actually talked to them, we realized actually what they were trying, they were asking for the feature because they were trying to do something, and the product actually already supported what they were trying to do. Mm-hmm. And it was just kind of buried in the product, which A, it ended up that, you know, we were able to solve the customer's problem without having to do any development work. And B, it educated us that, hey, you know, this feature is really valuable, but it's kind of buried. So we need to make it more obvious. Right. So I think those are always, you know, great learning opportunities.
Yeah, absolutely. Not accepting those requests just at face value and digging into them a little bit, like your example there, is the right thing to do. Understand them better. Good. We could talk a lot more about that one, but I want to move on to another topic that I know that I get asked about too, which is pricing and looking at pricing models and how do you determine the price for a new product in the B2B space or an upgrade? And what do you guys see in terms of pricing?
Yeah, this is an interesting area because it's something that even people who've been in product management for a long time, we find a lot of them are really uncomfortable with pricing. It's mm-hmm. one of those things you don't do it that often, you know.
Right.
You write user stories every day, you write requirements, you talk to customers, right? But you know, you might only price a half dozen products in your career potentially. So I think that's part of it. And I think also a lot of people think there's this kind of mystery and this mystic around pricing. So that's quite frankly the biggest challenge we see. I think the other maybe misconception is people really want to focus on the price. Like, what is the price? And really, we think about it in terms of, it's really about a pricing and packaging strategy. So in B2B, it's usually you don't have a product at a price, right? You'll have different tiers of products. You'll have different packages of products. Those will be aligned to different customer segments or different industries or different use cases. And so I think that's one of the mistakes we see is that people focus so much on that what is the number versus really trying to understand what is the whole strategy we have. And I think it goes back to some of the things we've already talked about, right? Understanding the different buyers and understanding value. So in your example earlier of the software that blocks websites from being used, I would bet that the IT buyer places a lot lower value on blocking websites than the HR manager does, right? So it could be the same exact product, but if we're selling, you know, if we sell it to the IT manager, they're thinking, all right, well, you know, hey, we could write software like this on our own. Why do we need to buy it, right? I can create some scripts and filter some URLs, and that's what they're thinking because they've got in their mind the problem is we just need to block some websites versus the value proposition to the HR manager might be something like, hey, we can keep you from getting sued. We can keep people from submitting sexual harassment complaints. We can keep, you know, viruses from infecting the company and creating downtime, right? So really pricing is a function of value. And I think the most important thing is to understand what the value is and what are the other competitors in a sense that to value. So I don't mean direct competitors, but you know, what are the ways that someone could solve this problem or address this need, and what are the comparisons? We do see a lot of companies focusing on competitive pricing, which is certainly important, but there's countless examples of companies that are not the lowest priced ones and have a better value proposition and are able to charge premium prices because they offer better value to the company. So I think that's another factor. A lot of times people think, oh, you know, we got to find out what our competitors are pricing, and then we got to do it, you know, slightly lower than them or slightly higher, right around there. But especially now with the move to SaaS, we're seeing a lot of companies implementing new pricing strategies, looking at different value metrics. So maybe instead of pricing by the user, we price by the number of projects you're running, or instead of pricing by, you know, the number of named access seats you get, you price by the amount of usage you have, or things like that. And so this idea of trying to identify the right value metric, as we call it, is a really important component.
I came across a couple of months ago a company that all they do is they provide pricing models for SaaS startups. So if you are creating a SaaS solution, they will figure out the optimal price for your solution for the target market that you're going after. I thought, that's an interesting business all by itself, that someone's focusing on that.
Yeah, I know there's a lot. I mean, this is getting a bit more into the B2C type things, but I've seen a lot of companies out there, a lot of examples out there where they're saying, like, you know, what's the ultimate pricing page look like, right? How do you, you know, get people to click the right button on that right pricing page, which, you know, there's certainly B2B companies where that is the situation. But again, I think the types of companies we work with at Serious Decisions, a lot of them are selling through a direct sales force, or if they have an e-commerce option that is, you know, one channel they sell through, but they have a number of additional channels as well. So, you know, yeah, how you determining that right price is important, but there's a whole lot of other factors. Again, for example, not just what the price is, but what goes in those different packages, right? How do we determine the basic versus the, you know, silver versus the gold? And what's the delta between the prices? Which things we include in each package? We're actually, you know, it's interesting to me. One of the things is we're seeing a lot of companies that are still talking about and challenged with moving from on-premise to SaaS, which to me is kind of surprising because we're 2017 right now, but there's still a lot of businesses that for various reasons, you know, a majority of their revenue has been on-premise. So that's one of the biggest pricing challenges or pricing questions we get is, all right, we've got this on-premise product. It's making a lot of money. It's doing well. Customers like it, but you know, we're being pushed to move to SaaS or competitors are moving to SaaS. So as we transition to SaaS, we need to look at a number of different aspects. One of which being, you know, how do we change again that pricing metric, that pricing, the value proposition from a pricing perspective? It also changes, you know, your sales model, changes how you compensate your salespeople. It changes how you, you know, build the product, but pricing and packaging is one of the things that, that definitely is one of the bigger questions there.
I think one of the key things that you talked about too earlier was understanding the value of the buyer and how are they solving or what are the other options for solving the problem? Like you said, not in terms of direct competitors, just what other actions do they take? And this really requires the product manager or some analyst to understand deeply how the prospect or the B2B customer thinks about the problem, who is involved in this problem, who does it really impact in the organization, and how much of a pain is it, right? And try to get that in terms of, you know, quantify it in terms of dollars of pain to these different roles. And then you start coming up with a model that says, oh, this is the actual value of this product for this organization.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things I remember hearing this years ago, you know, it's one of the basic rules, like you don't ask people how much they'd pay, right? If you ask me, how much do I want to pay for college when my kids are old enough to go? I can give you a pretty good answer, right? It's zero. I don't want to pay anything. So, you know, I think it's exactly what you said. It's understanding the value. You know, if you had this product, how would that change? Would it allow you to, you know, be more productive? Would it allow you to get more revenue? Would it allow you to reduce risk, protect from losses, right? And understanding that value and how that value differs for the different people involved in the buying process is really important.
Yeah.
So then that's one of the misconceptions.
I was going to say, in a college example, you know, if I was to position to tell you, well, I know your student, your child will make guaranteed minimum $80,000 a year in the first job. Is it worth $80,000 for 4 years of college for you? Well, then now you have something to compare it against, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So I think it is, it's a good example of, you know, what people say they want versus what they value is sometimes different.
Right. Excellent. Okay. So lots more things on pricing, but another quick topic I wanted to ask you about was this issue that comes up of the, I'm just going to call it the telephone game. And it's in organizations, and this probably happens more in B2B certainly, but you know, you have your company support, your customer service desk, and they probably have some escalation process that they go maybe to a level two support. But often when the product manager actually hears about a request or an issue, it's very indirect. It's gone through a few levels of interpretations, and we can lose that voice of the customer, you know, in those translations that go on. Thoughts on how, you know, when product managers get frustrated about this and they don't get the real message directly from the customer, what we can do about it?
Yeah, I'll start by saying that I think it is very difficult, if not impossible, to be a product manager, to be a good product manager, if you don't have opportunities to actually talk with customers, mm-hmm. with buyers, with end users. So, you know, that's the ultimate goal. And I remember talking to a couple of people where they said, look, you know, they've tried, you know, their organization doesn't want them to talk to people. They don't trust them, or, you know, salespeople have relationships, or, right. you know, there's a whole bunch of excuses for it. And they've essentially been beating their heads on the wall trying to figure out. And I said, look, you know, it sounds like you're not really getting anywhere. So you need to make a decision about, is this a job you want to do or not? Right. If that's the organization does not believe that it's important for the product manager to talk to customers, then is that an organization you want to be a part of? Because quite frankly, there are a lot of organizations that understand the role of product management and do realize that that's important. Mm-hmm. So I think there are completely legitimate reasons why it's difficult to talk to customers, but I think in many cases there are these are excuses or rationales that are given by various people who have a vested interest in not having the product manager talk to someone. Mm-hmm. So the most typical example I see is where sales owns the relationship. And there's this belief that, you know, back to sales, that, you know, oh, we should be the only one. We own the customer, quote unquote. Well, I don't like that because I don't think anyone owns the customer. I think, you know, there's reasons for many people in the company to interact with the customer. So again, it comes back to, you know, if there's not an understanding within the company about what the role of product management is, then no one sees the reason why we should encourage and help our product managers get in front of customers. So when sales has that relationship, I think part of it is, you know, again, working with the sales leadership, working with sales managers to help them understand, look, here's why it's important for us to talk directly. Because if we get something third hand, you know, we can't fix the problem. We can't address the issue based on, you know, a third hand comment that, you know, is one line of text in an email. So I'll say in my personal experience, you know, again, whenever requests have come in, I've used this opportunity to say, you know, hey, great. We really appreciate the feedback. Can I get on the phone with that person? Or can you and I get on the phone with that person and using the opportunity to try and do that? And you're not going to have 100% success rate, but I pretty much guarantee if you try this, you're not going to have a 0% success rate.
Right.
Right. So I think sometimes you just got to ask, you got to know the right thing. So maybe if the tech support people aren't the right ones, then you go to, well, do we have a support team or an implementation team or a services team? Or, you know, can we work with another group? Mm-hmm. Part of it, I think, also does require support from the product management leadership. So I've got a blog post. I think we can add a link in the show notes or
reference
if you want. There's a blog post. We talk about kind of the role of the product management leader in getting their product managers in front of customers, right? So saying, I want my people to get out of the office and talk to customers, but not doing anything to support them is really kind of an empty promise. So I think the product management leadership really plays a big role in making sure that those opportunities exist. And if people are putting up roadblocks, then you're clearing out those roadblocks. Now, that being said, let's talk about, you know, there are, again, legitimate situations where for whatever reason, we can't talk to customers. So this is where you need to get creative. I was working with a company that, without giving away too many details, basically they created software that pretty much anyone who works probably interacted with them or one of their competitors. And they were saying they were having a really hard time trying to get in front of their customers, or there were certain customers we could talk to, but other customers we couldn't. So I said, well, look, do your neighbors maybe use this software? Do you have colleagues, you know, who left their jobs years ago, or, you know, former college roommates, the friends and family approach is not ideal. But if you're really getting roadblocks, you know, that's the people you need to talk to. And quite frankly, I think a lot of companies are good at talking to their customers and very bad at talking to non-customers. And I've learned a lot more over my career from talking to people who use competitor products or who don't use any product than I have learning, you know, talking to my customers. I mean, talking to customers is great. But, you know, when you talk to a happy customer, you're going to get a very different perspective than when you talk to someone who chose a competitor's product over yours.
Exactly.
So, you know, not to ignore the internal comments, but I think there's a balance. And it's funny, this has come up actually a lot recently in a lot of the clients I'm working with, where we're doing some work to help their product managers find and identify and, non-customers that they can talk to for research.
Mm-hmm. That's a really important place, I think, often for us to start, actually, is we focus on the customers, which makes sense in B2B, right? We already have the customers. We're trying to sell them more, trying to serve them better. But it's the people who didn't choose our product or who's using the competitor's product that might actually have the best insights for new problems they have that we're not addressing yet. So, and I'm not talking about copying the competitor's products, right? But identifying new problems that we just haven't come across yet.
Yeah. You know, we're understanding, all right, you know, hey, rather, I think there's this tendency to think like, oh, you know, as a product manager, you want to be kind of the champion for your product, right? You need to be a cheerleader. You obviously like your product and think it's the best, but I think that sometimes can turn into hubris, right? So understanding, hey, why do people like the competitor's products better than ours? Or even if they like, you know, even when you win a deal, even when you do win loss analysis, even when you win a deal, there's probably something the competitor did better than you, even though they chose your company to go with. So to me, that's a great opportunity to learn, you know, what did we do well? And we want to keep doing that versus, and also what did we not do well that other people did better and how can we improve?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Excellent points. I want to switch gears and ask you for an innovation quote. And everyday innovators listening know I love innovation quotes, and I always ask my guests for one. We've had a really good discussion about some of the things involved in B2B product management, and we could keep talking about those for sure. But it is time to wrap up with you. So innovation quotes, what was one that you like, and why do you like it?
So this is one that I came up with probably 15 years or so ago. I can't remember the story of how I came up with it, but I think actually it relates really well to this conversation today. Mm-hmm. And it's no one wants a product. A product is just a way to help someone get whatever it is that they really want. And I think the reason why I think it's so important is because when I work with product management teams and product marketing teams as well, in particular, right, we want to talk about the product and the features and the functionality and the technology and all this, but no one really wants that, right? They're buying a product or a service to solve a problem and to address a need. So you want to start with, you know, who is that persona and what is that need? And then the product is just a way of addressing that. And I think that's something sometimes we get so hung up in the details of product management of, you know, what format should we use for writing requirements? And, you know, how should we structure user stories? And should we do 2-week sprints or 4-week sprints? And, you know, should we use Jira or Rally or version one, you know, all these things. And it's like, at the end of the day, it's what are the needs that we're trying to solve? And not to say those other things aren't important, because we need to be able to deliver a product. But, you know, I think keeping that in mind, I think is really important. It really can help make sure that you're developing the right offering. And particularly when you're marketing the offering, right? You don't want to take a product based approach to marketing, because no one really cares about your product. They care about a problem. And if you right. can connect with the need they have, then you're going to be in much better shape.
And this is a Jeff Lash original quote, right?
I think so. I will say I can't guarantee I wasn't influenced unintentionally by some other things I heard, but
well, sure.
But yes.
It encompasses that idea of like the jobs to be done framework, right? That people, you know, this goes back to Professor Levitt when he gave his talk about, you know, people don't want a quarter inch drill, they want to make a quarter inch hole, right?
So I would extend that into, yeah. So I go further. I say I don't think they want a quarter inch hole. I think they want to hang a picture on a wall.
There you go.
Right? Or they want to, you know, decorate their house. They want it to be a homey environment. I mean, you could take this to the extreme, but I think really fundamentally, okay, what is ultimately the not necessarily the discrete job to be done, but what is the need that you are trying to address?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great quote, and I think it embodies what we as product managers are about. Right. Mm-hmm. What is the customer actually trying to get done? And can you just share how people can find out about the work you do and the work you do there at Serious Decisions?
Sure. So our website is seriousdecisions.com. That's S-I-R-I-U-S, S-I-R-I-U-S decisions.com. We've got a blog where we post a lot of stuff. And actually, this is a good time. We just finished our annual Serious Decisions Summit, which is our big annual conference where we roll out a lot of our new research. So in the coming, you know, this week and coming weeks, you'll see a lot more posted there in terms of research we've just released, particularly around this, you know, not just on product management, but particularly some of the things around, you know, product and sales and marketing alignment. I'm also on Twitter. My handle is at Jeff Lash. That's J-E-F-F-L-A-S-H. And I'll also, we'll make sure that as you're recording this or updating that, there's a couple of links that I mentioned that we can mm-hmm. definitely do. I've got a number of blog posts that touch on some of the topics we've talked about, and I'm happy to have people reach out to me with questions or comments or thoughts.
Excellent. And Everyday Innovators, I will have the links to those resources in the summary in the show notes for this. So you can check those out and make that easy for you to get to. Jeff, I really appreciate the discussion on business-to-business product management, and thanks for taking time for this.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it and appreciate it.
Thanks for listening. I appreciate you telling other product managers and innovators about this podcast, and it's easy to do. Just go to the show notes, which is the show notes for this episode, of the summary of the discussion with Jeff, and you'll find links there at the top of the page for each of your favorite social media sites. Just click on one and share this with others. That resource is at theeverydayinnovator.com/127. That's /127. Keep innovating.
Thank you for listening to The Everyday Innovator, which teaches product managers to become product masters. For more resources, please visit our blog at theeverydayinnovator.com.